So we're looking at our last chapter, which is called Taking a Stand with Jesus, as John pointed out. And I'd like to begin with just a short reading of a paragraph or so. I'm on 147. And the Sermon on the Mount is found in chapter 5 of Matthew. It is an entirely Jewish document. Every word in it is either in the Hebrew Bible or rabbinical teaching. So that's the first thing for us to keep in mind, that this is an ancient presentation of a way of living that's different from what comes to us from our caveman ancestry. Because I don't think anybody would deny that this particular gene pool was born with certain birth defects. And that's sometimes called original sin. But teachers came along who showed us a way of living that offsets and reverses those automatic inclinations that are in us all toward aggression. So that's what this is about. So on 147, I start with St. Luke in chapter 6. He gives a briefer version of the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. It's not allowing abuse, but praying for those who do abuse you. The Sermon on the Mount is the new paradigm of human relating. It describes unconditional love in practical terms. So we've all heard the expression unconditional love. This shows us how to put it into practice. It spells out exactly how the grandiose, narcissistic ego can be transcended. Real faith always leads to love, and love is only possible when our ego-centeredness takes a bow. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus spares us no hideout, no disguise that the ego might don in his razor-sharp delineation of what love means. And he begins with reversing the ancient definitions of the two central concerns of people in ancient times. They had to save face. They had to be sure that people honored them. That was big in their consciousness. And to avoid ever being shamed by what they might do or what their relatives might do. We see this even now in the Middle Eastern world, that if your relative shames you in some way, she or he is the one who's punished. And it's interesting that so the shame is losing face. And it's interesting that in a book of 5,000 Egyptian dreams, someone in ancient Egypt recorded dreams, 5,000 of them. The most common theme was not, as you might think, sex. That was not the most common theme. The most common theme was the terror of losing face. Yeah, losing ego, basically. And the alternative to losing face was to gain face by having people acknowledge you as a stand-up kind of person. So, for instance, let's take a simple example. Aristotle, this is 3rd century before Christ. He's the tutor of Alexander the Great. And this is what he says in his book called The Rhetoric. To take just revenge on enemies, I'm the bottom of 147. To take just revenge on enemies and refuse to be reconciled. If they should say, you know, I'm sorry for what I did, so let bygones be bygones, let's bury the hatchet. If someone says that to you, if you say yes to it, that would be shameful. You have to say no to that. You have to demand revenge. Doesn't matter whether they ask for forgiveness. So he has that right here. To take just revenge on enemies and refuse to be reconciled. That is praiseworthy, honorable. For to retaliate is just. In other words, how do you bring about justice? You retaliate whether or not somebody even makes up for what they did. They stole $10 and gave you the $10 back. You still have to retaliate. So that was the belief part. Okay. Now, notice the phrase, refuse to be reconciled, and look on the next page. And now I'm quoting Jesus himself. When you're offering your gift at the altar, if you remember your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there and go. First be reconciled, then come and offer your gift. He's reversing Aristotle's view. He's basically reversing the definitions of honor and shame. For instance, it was shameful to be destitute. So, Beatitudes, blessed are the poor, blessed are the oppressed. They're on this side now. Whereas to the outside rest of the world, they're on the shame side. So, revenge would be the appropriate reaction to any insult or offense against you. Otherwise, you'll be looked down upon as being weak. And instead, he's proposing that you go ahead and forgive 70 times 7. You can ask for redress, you can ask for amends, but you don't demand it, and you have made your own vow that you will not retaliate, you will look for ways to reconcile. And remember that if you live in a world in which not to retaliate is shameful, and you go ahead and follow this teaching, you're also going to be looked down on by the other people because in their definition, it's more honorable to retaliate. So it's kind of a hits you in a double way, if you see what I mean. Okay, and if you have any questions as we go along, just bring them up. So let's just stay with this for a minute. I want to go back to the quote from St. Luke. So it starts with, love your enemies. So you have people who don't like you, you don't like them. They've done things to you that you consider unfair. Instead of saying, let them be, he's saying, actively love them. Then it's do good to those who hate you. Instead of saying, don't hate them back, he's going one further step and says, do good to them. And now, in San Francisco, I gave a talk at to the staff of a drug rehab program, and I talked about this because I was on the topic of retaliation, and one of the women said, "Why would you ever do good to the people who hate you?" And that's when I really got it. I thought, oh. You would have to have a special grace to believe this. Like when an ordinary person hears this, do good to those who hate you, they're going to answer the way she did. Why? Why would you do good? Why don't you just let them be, don't hate them, but why would you then do good? There's no motivation. The only motivation to do any of this is that you have been converted to a new way of living. That's the way of Christ. And it's not only of Christ, it's of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and all the original people who wrote this sermon. Bless those who curse you. So you're doing the opposite. They curse you. Instead of cursing them back, you're not only not cursing them, you're also blessing them. And finally, those who abuse you, mistreat you, you're not only not abusing or mistreating them, you're even praying for them. I consider this so challenging. I mean, here you have these four statements, and every one of them has the same point, which is go the extra mile, do something more than just not respond in kind. Because it could have been written this way. If people are your enemies, don't be an enemy to them. If people hate you, don't hate them. If people curse you, don't curse them. If people abuse you, don't abuse them. Even that would have been a big move for most people. But he's proposing something that's off the charts. Wait a minute, not only do I have to not be an enemy, but I even have to love them? How could I possibly do that? The only way I could do that is if something had happened in me, something had turned in me. Turned from where? It turned from the ancient style, the caveman to classical antiquity style of honor and shame. And somehow it had reversed, and I had a whole new way of living. The Latin word for this kind of turning is conversion. I remember going to Mass on the feast of the conversion of St. Paul, and I remember thinking to myself, gee, I wonder if I'll ever be converted fully. I see so many things in me that aren't yet converted. Like the full message has not taken root in me. So that's my challenge. When they hate me, I'm not only not going to hate them, I'm going to do good, and so forth. Well, what would make this possible? And my friend Dennis Rivers, who's here with us, gave me some way of expressing this, which I'd like to share. And I think it helps us understand the difference between the way we were brought up and the new possibilities that are in us, all described by the Sermon on the Mount. So your first experience in life is the sense that you belong. First, you belong to the family. I'm in this family. Next door, there's another family. I belong to this family. I have this mother, this father, and so forth. So you begin with belong. When you go to school, I belong to this school, not the one two neighborhoods away. When you go to church, I belong to this church, not the other church. You start with belong. The first thing that happens in this connected place of belonging is that they show you how to behave. So in the family, share your toys, don't throw food around, etc. They teach you how to behave. Go to school, they teach you how to behave. Sit still, line up, don't talk in class. Go to church, they tell you how to behave. 10 Commandments. Then they also ask, now we're getting to the religious part of it, in the religious experience, they also ask you to believe. So not only is there a certain way of behaving, and not only are you belonging, But there are also things to be believed without evidence, such as virgin birth, risen Christ, Exodus. But the big challenge may never have come to us. Not only belong, believe, belong, behave, believe, but what about become Christ on earth in your personal daily life? I live now, not I, but Christ lives in me. Words of St. Paul. So this is a bigger challenge than just believing and behaving. Now we have a new possibility, which is, oh, I can become like the one whom I honor as God, that is Christ. I can actually act like him in the world. How would you act like him in the world? Spelled out very clearly in the Sermon on the Mount. Then you would love your enemies, do good to those who hurt you, so forth. So that's the moment. When you made this decision, I would like to become like him in all things. That's the equivalent of the conversion moment. And some of us never got to that. In Protestantism, they have a very specific ritual. You're baptized as an infant, and then when you're an adult, you're asked to stand up and make your statement that you really do take Christ as your Savior, that you intend to live in accord with his teachings. Our version of that is confirmation, but it happens at such a young age that you don't quite think of it this way. So I moved from belonging to behaving and believing to becoming, and finally, it's to be Christ. Not just become like him, but be. And that would be the full experience of the conversion. This being, this simply, so there's no longer much of a distinction between myself and Christ. This would be the style of one who, as I say here in the book, has as his first reaction, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. So in the becoming, you're practicing this and you're doing all the things that help you get to the point of reversing the old honor and shame paradigm. But when it just happens automatically, that's when you've finally arrived. This happens in St. Francis and St. Therese. They got to the B part. And so can we, because the grace is always being offered to us to get there. Everybody following so far? Anybody have a question or something to add to what I'm saying? Margaret, you want to come up to the microphone? Or do you want to say it and then I'll repeat it? Oh, okay.
How could you possibly love somebody who kills your mother?
Okay. I get the question. She says, how can you possibly love certain people who do the unforgivable? And that's a very deep and important question, which I've thought a lot about. It's when you realize that the forgiving kind of love has nothing to do with excusing. So to forgive is not the same as excuse. But if someone has hurt you in a very deep way or hurt someone that you love, as an example Margaret gave, you could get to the point of three letting goes. You could notice that you have let go of ill will. In other words, I hope he dies. I hope he has a terrible accident. You're letting go of ill will. You're letting go of the ongoing hate and resentment. And you're letting go of the need to retaliate. I no longer feel like I have to get back at him for what he did. I no longer hate him. I just feel sorry for him, whatever. And I no longer have ill will toward him. These three let goes are the equivalent of the healthy forgiveness. So with this view, there's nothing unforgivable. But even this view is lacking when it comes to the Sermon on the Mount. Because look what he says. Love those who hate you and so forth, or who have hurt you. So here's the new proposal. Not just let go of ill will, but have goodwill toward the one who hurt you so deeply. Not only not hate the one who hurt you, but even love that one. Not only let go of the need to retaliate, but look for some type of reconciliation. So let's take it from the top. We have someone has hurt us, so hurt them back. Hurt back. Now you have everyone from caveman to Aristotle teaching Alexander the Great. Then you have the humanistic view, what you would find in a self-help movement, what you would find in an approach that helps you move through things in a way that doesn't ultimately hurt you. So that's the forgive, let go of the ill will, hate, need to retaliate. And then we come to the third possibility, which is the over-the-top one. That's what Jesus presents to us. Not only let go of the ill will, but have goodwill and so forth. So this is a really good outline of the overall challenge, and it helps us see that what we're being asked to do when we get to the point of being Christ. Now you have a whole new way of operating. Jackie.
Sometimes letting go is the hard part.
Yeah.
You haven't said how we let go. And I can speak from personal experience. I have shared this story with a group before, so I won't tell all its details again. But I was unable to let go. I didn't realize that I hadn't let go. I was totally unable to let go until... out of God's mercy, he sent me a dream in which I let go in the dream, and it stayed that way. But I could not do it on my own.
Glad you brought that up, because I also believe the letting go is a grace. In the self-help movement, it's through a series of practices. In Buddhism, it's the practice of loving kindness. That's how you let go. You keep saying over and over again, may he be happy, may he find the enlightened way, may he be free of all the hate and aggression that's in him. You keep repeating that over and over again, that helps you let go. And I'm proposing that it takes more than that, it also takes a special grace. And Jackie has pointed out that sometimes the grace comes in a dream.
Yeah. Isn't the concept of turning the other cheek, doesn't it go farther than this?
Yes. Turn the other cheek would be, and that also is, shall we say, over-the-top style. So in that view, which I don't have on our three-part list here, you would even welcome the hurts. I consider that a very special calling. So I don't quite relate to it. But and nowadays, with all our awareness of not putting up with abuse, we don't really go there. But yes, that would be another calling. Like the holy martyrs were certainly in that category. Hi.
Hi.
Kate.
I don't want to take too much time. Basically, I want to say that when you talk about honor and shame and the hurt back, that's, you mentioned Aristotle. So that's in the Greek-Roman tradition, which is definitely not the Jewish tradition. Jesus was expounding upon exactly the Jewish tradition, which is a way of living. And it's called halakha. It's the law. And there were 613 things that, you know, the mitzvot that we are commanded to do. To love your neighbor as yourself is one of the biggest. And then, you know, the visit the sick, help the poor, feed the hungry, all those things. That was Jesus was speaking on the mount from the halakha. So, in terms of Margaret's, how can you forgive the Nazis? What we have to understand is that the existence of the Nazi evil was a time when we were asked by God to be his partner and to stop the evil. The Jews, during this time, when they were confronted with, they're going to take us and kill us all, there was a voicing by one of the rabbis that said, God's going to save us. But ever since Noah and the flood, which was a time when he wiped everybody out except for the people on the ark, he wanted to start over. He did put the rainbow in the sky as a covenant that he's never going to do it that way again. Only the Nazis tried to exterminate all of Judaism. That was their hope, is that it would be eradicated. But it's a way of living which underscores Christianity at its very basis. It was Jesus. So, I don't think we have to say to Margaret, oh, you have to forgive the Nazis. We have exterminated the Nazi evil. And we have the prayer, never again. So now all of us who are God's children, Christians and Jews, everybody, we're asked to stand up for those who are being the genocide of Darfur or the refugees. We are being called as a humanity. So in terms of your progression about forgiving, as Jesus said, the Jews are asked every year to go through a cycle where before they come to God on Yom Kippur to be forgiven for our year's transgressions, we have to go to the individuals that we may have transgressed and ask for forgiveness and get forgiveness and give forgiveness. It has to be done in the days of awe, in the time between Rosh Hashanah, the new year, and, you know, for 10 days, God is right there in the fields. That's why it's called the day of awe. We are going to what would be our enemy and trying to understand them and get closure and forgiveness. And then we can come to God. And of course, if we've done our work, then we're forgiven before we even ask. But it's in terms of an enemy that we had a relationship with. It was our doing. I don't think we can be asked to love the terrorists or ISIS, which is a whole different notion of enemy. I think Jesus was dealing in a time when it's person to person. So in terms of the Jews, we're brought up with that loving kindness being modeled in the home. and we are becoming God's partner from infancy. There isn't a sense of you have to get, you know, you have to make up for something, you know, the original sin. We're brought up with loving kindness and a yearly cycle of festivals centered in the home to raise the person as a loving human being.
Well, thank you very much. That's very clear, and I like everything you said. It makes perfect sense. And it's good to see that this is the same perspective as in Judaism. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Dave. I was reflecting on this idea of grace. And maybe I don't understand it, but I see grace as something that comes to us that we have no control over it.
Right.
So, forgiving is a daily reality for us. And the idea that we depend on something that is only given to us beyond our control to become something that is very important and big is a little discouraging. So, however, Jackie gave me an idea there. Wouldn't it make more sense for something as important as learning to forgive, that God would built in our humanity a way to help us progress rather than something that we just depend on whenever. So I thought Jackie kind of showed the way. Maybe psychology shows the way that forgiving is not something that we can necessarily always do consciously, that there are deeply hidden pains that the dreams can heal. The subconscious maybe there's better than talk therapy, in mm-hmm. other words. And if anything, these maybe God leads us to the way of new ways of looking, like the new energy therapies, like EMDR that helps the vets get over PTSD, talk of forgiving. You know, PTSD is just absolutely stunting. So anyway, I was just thinking maybe we need to look for a better way, and that God has already granted the grace of this way. Mm-hmm. And Jackie showed that the dreams are one way that our human nature wants us to move on, and that the Spirit will talk to us. Anyway, that's what I was saying. The idea of grace and depending on it, even though it sounds wonderful, it's not very encouraging for something we need daily, you know.
Okay, thank you. Maybe it would help to look at it this way, because you asked a good question, which is there something else we can turn to in ourselves? And you're right. We can turn for messages to our unconscious. They come to us in dreams, for instance. But also, consciously, and this is the part that's the built-in grace, is in every person, there is a full and intact capacity to love. I'll never forget on the anniversary of the Shoah, it was the closing of one of the camps like Auschwitz, and on 60 Minutes, they had a little section on this, and they had a famous and very wise rabbi. Mike Wallace was interviewing him, and this is the question he asked. He said, "You say you're the chosen people, but yet you were so terribly treated during World War II by the Nazis and all the silent people around them who participated in your extermination. In what sense do you use that phrase, chosen people?" And I remember thinking, oh my Lord, I wouldn't be able to answer this question. But this is what he said without the slightest blinking of an eye, and I thought it was so beautiful and so perfect. He said, "We're chosen in the sense that even though there have been all these pogroms and exterminations throughout history, we never lost our capacity to love. That's how we're chosen. He said, it isn't that you take it literally that somebody's going to intervene and make everything come out all right. He even said, I don't even think the parting of the Red Sea actually happened. What happened was oppressed people were able to go on loving. So I expanded that in my own mind and I said, oh, okay, so that actually refers to all humans. We've all been hurt in so many ways from the beginning until now of our lifetime. But look, something has survived. That's the capacity to love, always available, and that's the what I call our interior grace. And then our interior voice of God is unconscious, our unconscious. And this unconscious shows itself in two basic ways, in dreams and in synchronicity. Unusual coincidences in which things come together for you. You know you didn't cause it, but there it is, and it really helps you. So these would be considered graces also. In that sense, grace is always available. But the challenge of living in accord with statements about living in accord with the sermon that says love your enemies and so forth, that will take more than just grace. That will take practice also. And on page 150, I give some recommendations of these practices. For instance, you can seek reconciliation and forgiveness from others. You can do what Kate brought up and what they do in the AA program, make amends and ask for amends. You can choose nonviolence in your disputes. You can live by example, teach by example, not by coercion. You can be generous. You can return good for evil. You can respect love and wisdom over position and wealth. You can let go of anxiety about how things will turn out because you have a trust that an absolute loyalty and honoring of what occurs is the true path to freedom from fear. And finally, you can let go of judgment and competitiveness. And instead of judging, you can have compassion. Instead of competing, you have cooperation. So we can do things like this. That full conversion takes grace. But we can do some things. Examples in what I just read out. Hi.
Hi. So earlier you were talking about the process of becoming Christ-like and being.
Yeah.
Do you think that the answer to the question of how do we forgive a huge hurt is if we are Christ, we will be forgiving. So the farther down that progression we get,
yeah,
the more likely we are to be able to have the grace to forgive.
Yes. Yes, that's a good way to put it. The further down you are, if all you have is that you belong to the church, and you behave in the way the church recommends in most areas, and you believe in what the church teaches for the most part, and that you have understood that becoming more and more like Christ in the world is a good idea and you are trying it, the further down the list you get, especially when you get to the what you just brought up, where you just automatically are like Christ and are Christ in the world, then it's easier and easier to forgive. If you only have the belonging, it's going to be hard to forgive. If you only have the belong and behave, that'll be hard, etc. Everybody get the basic concept? Okay. Dennis? Oh, this is Dennis and this is his idea. So here he is.
Well, it seems to me there's a hidden component in that question of how will I forgive the seemingly unforgivable? And that is, we're asking that question, how will I forgive the seemingly unforgivable while otherwise remaining pretty much the same person I've always been? And that is probably the great challenges of forgiveness wind up being challenges to sort of reorganize oneself, somewhat the way you shake a kaleidoscope. When you shake a kaleidoscope, all the same beads are there, but they fall into a new pattern. So it does seem like these giant challenges to forgive represent challenges for us to become the kind of next person on our pilgrimage through life. Because our pilgrimage through life is kind of like, this has one transformation after another. The other thing I wanted to comment on was that the Dalai Lama, when he came here to Santa Barbara, made a wonderful suggestion about this. And it has stuck in my mind ever since. He said, when someone injures you, think of a circumstance in which you yourself could be so confused that you would do exactly that same thing, or you would make exactly that same mistake. And then you won't carry the person around inside of you as a demon anymore. They're just one more confused human being. Because we've all been confused. We've all been angry to the point where we've done things that we later regretted. So that sets the stage for us to say, oh yes, that person over there is one more confused, suffering human being who does things that cause pain. And on that basis, we can have compassion. Perhaps maybe we, when we think about using the word love, we attach all sorts of positive emotions to it. There could be different versions of love. There could be gentle, compassionate acceptance. Yes, I accept that person as a suffering human being who makes all sorts of mistakes. And may they find their way to a more humane way of being in the world, which is the same thing I wish for myself.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis. That's very helpful. So we're really going deeply into this topic, and I'm so glad we're doing this. And all the things that people have shared have helped deepen what I'm bringing up. I mean, I'm learning a lot from all that you're saying. But I just want to say one last thing on the be Christ. You might look at it this way, that each of us gives Christ the opportunity of a lifetime, literally, this lifetime of David and this lifetime of Jenny are unique ways that Christ lives his life again. He didn't just live in Israel from the year 0 to 30. The meaning of resurrection is he is still living, and every single human is giving him that opportunity. So when you ask for the grace to be Christ in the world, what you're really asking for is what's already true. It's just that now you want to show it. This has already happened. It happened at your birth. So all that's left is, oh, then how do I act that way? And he showed us how. Matthew 5. Sermon on the Mount. Beatitudes. Full list of exactly what it would take. And we'll talk a little more about that after our break. All right, so let's take a short break and then we will come back.